So we have a special show for you this week. We have done our first live show, and it went a little long, and so we're breaking it up actually into three episodes. This is part two of our live show. We did not do any editing or any audio polishing of the episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like these, please consider becoming a patron. We're going to start doing these more often. The video and the interactive chat is exclusive to our patrons.
This is Iconic.
All right, well, let's get into our topic for today. Only 30 minutes into our episode. This is why we're going to break this up into several episodes. Please keep asking questions. Like, we are here for you. We're going to try and do these more often. If you guys like them, these are going to be shows for and by the patrons in a lot of ways. So, yeah. But our topic today is our favorite campaigns. So here are kind of the ground rules. We're going to have each person we're going to bounce around, kind of introduce the campaign you're talking about, why it was special to you. People can ask questions about the campaigns that you were running. And then why did it stand out to you? These are the questions we're kind of asking. And then what did you as a GM or as a player take away that you have incorporated kind of into your ongoing RPG experience? So what we're really trying to do is partially give you some nostalgia time, but also like distill what we've learned from our years of playing into what was the core takeaway from this kind of a game. So, Mark, I'm going to start with you. What is one game that really stands out to you? Were you the player? Were you the GM? And why?
I was the GM for...
Oh, Mark.
D&D 1. Heart. The A and then GDQ series from long ago. This was my second foray into running. And this time I designed the whole campaign. I had these adventures that I purchased over the years, read them, never got... Well, some of them I had played in here and there, but... I was stationed in Germany, found some guys who were like, oh yeah, I played that in high school. I was like, you know what? Why don't you come over? We'll have a couple beers and we'll play. And I ran a campaign for 2.5 years with the same group. And it was great. Now these were all set in the world of Greyhawk. I didn't have that stuff. Couldn't find it. It was also my first world building. So I took part of the map from the Silmarillion that started me and I just expanded it. Just stole the names, but it was my world. And I plopped these in there and we ran up. We never actually finished. Zempton Cracksford, the Ranger Lord, got the 13th level when they finally had to leave Germany. And we never finished it. And this was great. So it was first for me as world building. I had a 3-ring binder that I took the names from that map, if you've read that book.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it my own world. And who was the king? Who was the queen? Who did they trade with? Who were the allies? How large was their army? Who were the lords under them? And this was pre-computer, so it was a big sheet of paper that I took pen, paper, and crayons and colored it, and we hung it on the wall, and it was great. And we'd add stuff as they did stuff to it.
Now, did you start with T? Did you go T, GDQ, or
no,
did you just
this,
do GDQ?
The A series starts at 4th level, so I did A1 to 4. So I had to kind of come up with some things beforehand to get them up to 4th level. And then we started on the A series and they came across the whole conspiracy of these slaves. And then they get into the GDQ. And this history of D&D wise, this was a big deal because in the DQ series, you meet the Drow, which is a brand new race. First edition had been out for years and they introduced... What do you mean there's evil elves? They're all good. This whole race from under, subterranean. And it was a big thing in the D&D world back then.
Now,
not that you can tell anybody. See, that was the difference between you guys meeting people in school and saying, hey, you want to play? See, I got to play. And then I don't tell anybody in school that we play this because it was the 1980s. And, it was a different,
Yeah, you kept it all, you had to hide it. Now, for those of you watching or listening who don't know what these acronyms are, T refers to the Village of Hamlet and the Temple of Elemental Evil series. I see Becca going, that's just what is being talked about. The A, so these were modules like D&D, like instead of putting out like 1 to 15 campaigns, they would put out these little individual stories that you could just drop into your own campaign world. So A was against the slavers, where you were fighting the slavers of in Greyhawk. They weren't the Scarlet Brotherhood, were they?
I don't remember. Okay. I don't think so.
The G series was about each G module dealt with a different giant. The D series was the drow. And then the Q was the Lolf, which was like the queen of the demon web pits.
Yeah. You go to fight Lolf.
Yeah.
That's an app.
So yeah. Any questions from either the viewers or from you guys as we go in there? And by the way, if you guys like the show, if you guys like Iconic Production, if you guys like Iconic Podcast, please be sure to like this video on YouTube. Be sure to comment, subscribe on YouTube. We do have a Twitch channel on Iconic Production. We are not just talking heads, but we are talking heads. We're just not just talking heads. So, yes, Mark, yours is the prettiest talking head. So, Nick, do you have any questions for Mark here?
So when you were describing keeping all of your world building stuff in a 3-ring binder and it getting thicker and thicker and thicker over the years, how did you index that or keep track of what's where and the important bits that you may have established in one session?
And
20 sessions later, also reference it and make sure that you're not contradicting yourself.
I just made notes on it. I didn't really tab it. It was just one of these big 3-inch binders that it grew, from the 1-inch to the 2-inch to I borrowed a big 3-inch binder from work and document protectors. And I had it kind of set up by the countries, Himlad was one area. So I had that insert and notes on it as they went there. So a lot of the stuff I created as you do in world building, and they never went to that area of the world. So it's just the basic entry that I started with, but just where they were at. Yeah. I went through, cause Jam and I both advocate this, steal everything you can. I went through a lot of the old fantasy novels and I just took great names and I just wrote them down. And I used them, I would just cross them off and I made a note. The bartender's name is, Bob, but instead of coming up and, like off the cuff and not thinking, I had this list, cross it off. And I wrote down, in this town, there's a blacksmith named Hilgoth and did some work for him. So when they came back.
I'm reading through Elric of Milnibane right now, and that is sparking a lot of imagination. But I'm going to steal a bunch of stuff from that.
Oh, yeah, that's great. That's great.
So what would you say you took out of this as a player or a GM that from that moment on, you started plotting this forward?
Well, it was a great experience for me to have modules that kind of had the adventure and like the A series were all linked, but I could put them in my world and I didn't have to worry that from A1 to A2, they should go to this town, but they decided to go there. I just shifted it and made it there, or I gave them a contact there that would direct them a different way. So being a lot more flexible than my first foray where I had followed it word by word, but nah. And if it took them a while to get to the next phase, that was okay. And I didn't really set it up that, okay, finish day one of getting into A2. They would go off and investigate. I also had, they were great when dungeons, the Dragon Magazine and the Dungeon Magazine was published because sometimes they'd have a little small adventure in there. So you could insert it in. A little side quest had nothing to do with the main quest, which to tell you the truth, the players don't know. Is this important to go into this cave and get the raiders? It has nothing to do with the main story. But they're looking for that information. They just toss these caves and I have to find it. There's no connection, but they didn't know that, which is great because it kind of builds that tension of this is important. No.
All right. Well, let's jump over to Becca. Becca, What is your first campaign that you wanted to share with the Iconic listeners and patrons, and kind of give us the overview? Tell us about it.
The first one, the one that I think back to when asking about like your favorite campaign, is really my first one as well. I started with the Player's Handbook and my dad's dice from the 70s.
Did you have to color those numbers back in?
On some of them, yeah. It was one of those that were like, does this have the dot? Does this not have the dot? I can't tell. Two sessions in, or maybe it was the third session, we took a field trip to a game store and everybody bought a set of dice because we couldn't do it anymore. The trying to figure out what's what was just too much. So we're like, we want our own dice. So yeah, there was five of us and we went on a field trip to the game store, three sessions in. So I think it's most memorable because it was my first game and it was everyone else's first game. It was all good friends. It was all women to begin with, because that was who I could rope into it, because I knew they were available. And I didn't know what I was doing, and neither did they. And we had a single player's handbook among six of us. And we just kind of went with it. But the way that they made their characters their own was really cool. I had pre-made all the characters. I made them all wrong the first time around. And later went back and fixed everybody's character and gave them ones that actually the math worked. But one of the biggest things was being able to go back and admit mistakes on both my part as well as the players and change it and fix it. But it also gave me the confidence as a GM to tell my players, go for it. Try it. Like, I don't know how this works, so let's figure this out together. And I think that really influences in my GM style, in that my players go wherever they want to go. And you notice that in the 13th Age game that I run Monday nights. I have no control over that story.
Yeah. Plug.
I mean, yes. But, like, the current villain is a villain because of the choices the players have made. When my players decided to, you know, cut off heads and pull out hearts and drug their teammates, I'm going, oh, I mean, go for it. You've just turned yourself evil.
Yeah.
Congratulations. I now have a villain. I didn't plan for this. So I definitely took from my first game the ability to try anything and then implement it into the world and into the game again. So I would love to go back. I'd love to finish it. We kind of just stopped because, similar to Mark, people left. I want to see, I mean, I ended up inviting different people in as the group changed, and I did invite JM into the group. And it was one of those things where every single NPC this group met, they made into an enemy. And so I told JM, if you come and you play with us, bring a backup character, because they're probably going to kill you. And so
I took the character that I had, that I wanted to play, this high elf fighter, which, damn it, I still just want to play a high elf fighter in it. D&D game, and instead I made this warlock, like, bat shit freaking cleric, or what was it, a warlock of the great old ones?
Yeah. And, like, yeah, because every single NPC I'd given these people, they had made an enemy of, introduced another, like, had another friend come to play, and before he showed up, they had already named his character Mr. Thunderpants. And so, and this was not JM's character, this was someone else. But like, so I was telling him, like, you're not going to get to play your the first character you show up with. They robbed JM's character, like, first thing. And then they were like, yeah, you can stick around. I guess we won't kill you.
So then I played that character till the end of the campaign.
Yeah. He kept trying to get him killed. Everybody kept healing him. Then he tried to, like, pick fights with some of the other characters to see if they would kill him. But they had too much honor, even though the player was getting mad at JM. We tried. We'll try another time, buddy.
That's right. So do you guys have any questions for Becca about this campaign? Before we go into kind of what her take... I mean, we kind of talked about her takeaway.
So did JM point out that, you know, there's other books besides the Player's Handbook that might facilitate running?
When I joined, she was running Curse of Strahd. Like, she had the magnificent D&D panoply of books.
So, yeah, I started with just the Player's Handbook and then got the Dungeon Master's Guide and then the Monster Manual fairly soon after buying our own dice sets. And then I think for Christmas, someone got me the Curse of Strahd, Princes of the Apocalypse.
This is one of the few, like, hey, Jam, you want to play my fifth edition game? And maybe partway through the session, Jam's like, what rules are you using?
Yeah, so I did my own world and made up some basic things to get them through level 1 and 2. And then I picked up the Curse of Strahd and ran them through the haunted house.
The murder house?
Yeah, at the back of the book, and traumatized 3 of my players for life. Yeah, they don't want to ever go into a house again anytime I'm running a game. But yeah, so I was pretty much running Curse of Strahd, and then one of my players wished vampires out of existence. So we no longer had a curse to deal with. So we went on a different adventure. Yeah.
It was good times.
It was good times.
You had said your players had a tendency of getting all of your NPCs angry at them and turning all of them villainous in some way. Did you ever run into a situation where you had a favorite NPC? Like, I like this NPC. I want the players to have a positive interaction with them, and then players just win against that?
Yeah, the very first session, I introduced Victor the Blacksmith, a character from Critical Role that Matt Mercer created, the very harmless yet crazy gentleman who was discovering the properties of gunpowder, black powder. And so I was like, he's going to ask you to go. Like, in my brain, I'm going, here's this nice, crazy old man. He's going to ask you to go get something for him. Like, go get the MacGuffin. The players barge in, like, crash open the door, yank back a tarp, like, start going through all of his stuff. And this poor NPC is sitting there going, hi, what are you doing? I asked you to come here to, like, help me. Why are you robbing from me? Like,
and they really put the murder hobo in murder hobo.
They really did. One of my players put a cone of truth on a series of council members who looked at them and went, okay, 2 can play this game, and cast a cone of truth or zone of truth on that character, which pissed off the character. And I was like, okay, so what you're feeling now is what the council members are feeling.
Empathy.
Like, maybe that wasn't the best choice if you want them to, you know, befriend you. On the flip side, Nick, I had a blue dragon that was supposed to be the big bad guy. At the end of the campaign, he and another player character are getting married.
I was going to play their child coming back from the future.
Yep.
Windwalker Ravenwright.
Yep. The blue dragonborn.
Well, with as villainous as you, as it sounds your characters are, it kind of makes sense that they would hook up with another villain.
I mean, it really does.
That's fun, though.
Like, okay, like, here's a series of people who can help you. Oh, you insult them to their face. Okay, here's a villain. You're seducing them. Like, what is going on right now? I'm so confused.
Nick, what about you? What's the first campaign that comes to mind for you?
I think it would be the Numenera, the Absolutist War that you ran. That's probably my favorite campaign that I've played in thus far. Part of it was because it was the longest campaign that I played in. I mean, we were between 2 and 3 years going strong on that. We didn't really have any player turnover, but we had a fair amount of character turnover. That being said, I think my character was the only one that lasted from start all the way through finish. Lemnos kind of is still around.
Lemnos wasn't in the original start, like, but when he came in, he survived to the end. But
right, and there's a sense that he's still there-ish.
Yeah, Lemnos the city still exists now.
Right. So that stood out to me for a number of reasons. One of the things that I really liked about it was because it was such a long campaign. I was in my character survived as long as he did. I was able to see a lot of character changes that took place in him, and not just character growth, but actually like very core level changes in motivation, changes in their perception of things. And that was driven because of the choices of the other characters and the other players at the table. A couple days ago, I went back and read over the eulogy I had written up for Scales. And I mean, it ripped my heart again. I'm thinking, yeah, that was a very decisive moment for my character. And he changed from being this very vengefully focused character to being one that was, I'm not going to go down the path of vengeance anymore. I'm done with that path. I'm going to pursue justice now. And yeah, so many memories, so many good times. And then it was interesting pulling out of that. I had created that character trying to kind of explore this idea of vengeance and anger and that sort of reaction to situations just for my own player sake. I was just, you know, what would it be like if this was the mindset of somebody? And then very quickly realizing I didn't like that, but then seeing the redemption that took place in that. Yeah, I still remember that torture scene. And that.
Yeah, I do too.
It went the way it should have gone, but afterwards I was like, I did not like that. So it was good though. Yeah, I took away a lot of things from that. You know, we kind of, in a sense, we stretched and broke the cipher system. We pushed it to the limits and realized it doesn't hold up well in these sorts of situations. So we did a lot of house rules, trying new things, bringing in new mechanics. JM, you did a great job in trying this stuff out and having it work. And at the same time, being able to come back and say, yeah, that didn't work out so well. Let's change this as well. It was interesting seeing the benefits of having a very narrative focused campaign because it put everything in the hands of the players. But then when there were things that weren't in the hands of the players anymore, that's where I saw there was weaknesses in a completely narrative focused campaign as well. And the benefit that boundaries bring into a game and into a campaign. You know, I was thinking of Kame's self-sacrifice. And mechanically speaking, as other players, we could have rescued her. But that was a player choice that superseded all of the mechanical aspects of the game. And
we had some players who were angry about that, but like Ben had come to me and said, I am sacrificing my character for this. What will it buy me?
Right.
And this is not on my list, but that's something I learned from L5R. Like L5R has always had the explicit or implicit rule that if a character is willing to sacrifice their life for something, take all of the mechanical restrictions off and say, what is it that you want your life to buy? And then run with it.
Yeah, and that brings interesting dynamics when you have other players who, mechanically speaking, they can save this character. But the answer is still no. The sacrifice is still going to go on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was good.
I sometimes still go back and read the write-ups and then exist in a beautiful melancholy for the rest of the day.
I think one of the cool things that I experienced in that campaign that I try to bring into my games now is make sure that the dots get connected and make sure that the dots are meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the seemingly mundane choices that you make in an interaction in a tavern or in a particular setting of some sort, make that meaningful, make that a dot that you can connect something else to down the road. And then when that comes to fruition, it ends up being a really big aha moment of, I didn't realize all this was connected. And maybe it wasn't at the time, but it was afterwards.
Yeah. Any questions for Nick? I don't feel like I have a good question to ask because I ran that game. So I'm just nodding along. But that was your first real long-term campaign that went from start to end.
Yep. I played in a number of other campaigns that lasted, months or a number of levels, but that was the first one from start to finish, level one, or in this case to tier six. Wrapped up all of the loose ends as best as we could and called it. We had a really good conclusion to it.
Yeah.
Nick, did you then find, so you're saying with this character, you started with this idea of revenge and anger. Did you find that through changing or through the own character changing, you put more of yourself into the character, or did they remain somewhat dissonant from you?
I think there was, I think I have a pretty good separation between player and character. And so I can play a very different character than who I am. But as the sessions wore on, I think there was a bit more of a, this is not who I am, and I want to be able to relate with this character since this is going on for a long time. And that certainly may have affected the shifting that took place, some of the choices. But then, honestly, some of it was just that the player, honestly, the player revulsion to what my character was doing. I was like, I don't like that. And if I keep going down this road, this what it's more going to be like. So there were certainly some things in that. I think after that torture scene, I, as a player, was starting to pull back a little bit of, I don't want to quite take things that far. But no, it wasn't until many sessions later that that shifts took place fully in the character.
Right.
Now, Mark and I have both had characters that we have played the character to the point where we were like, I can't play this character anymore. And just, you either have to make a hard change before that point, or it's totally okay to go to your GM and be like, I don't want to play this character anymore. They ride off into the sunset.
I did.
I mean, I've done it too.
Robard the Ugly. I don't know. Becca, were you in that group already?
He came in after Robard.
He came in afterward, yeah.
Yeah, I came in with your new character because you had gotten rid of him.
Yeah.
Yeah. You
he was playing a rogue, and he wasn't a nice guy.
We don't go into details.
He crossed the line, and for several days after that session, and Jan was like, "Oh yeah, we'll just roll with it. The consequences, as if you played in Jan's game." But I went to him, and I was like, "Dude, I can't play this guy anymore. I did not feel good."
Mm-hmm.
I was into the character, and I think he did what he would have done. I didn't was just being mad at Jan. But I felt bad. I was like, I can't play this character. This is dark side. He's now an NPC.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the first one.
My other campaign, I was going to talk about a different one, but I was thinking about now. I played for a long time, but the Exalted campaign with my samurai, I really got
the
into.
The Anima one.
Yeah, Anima.
Yeah.
And that was the first character I played that in several scenes brought me to tears in the game.
Yeah.
It was very emotional connection to this day, if you see a picture of a cherry blossom, I get choked up.
All right, well, let's jump into this. So if you guys aren't familiar, Anima is this Final Fantasy-esque RPG from Spain. The art is very anime style. The world is like, I mean, Final Fantasy, like Final Fantasy 3 comes to mind. And it has so many bizarrely complex subsystems. My wife bought it for me for my anniversary, and I was like, all right, let's give it a shot. I didn't really expect it to be longer than a short-term game, but it was one of our like best games from the group. Do you want to explain a little bit on like what it was about your samurai that like, and why that campaign kind of stood out to you?
Well, I think it was, we had played before different games, a lot of times at the game store or different things, or you'd pop in for a session. But I think that was the first campaign that you ran that I played in.
Hmm.
And we've done some since then. I mean, I was looking at my notes because he's going to come into play in the future. And I want to say this is back like 2008, 2009. So this is quite a few years ago. I don't know what clicked with that guy. I mean, before I wasn't, you know, strictly a murder hobo, you know, kill a monster, loot its body. But I really got into that character. I don't know if it was, I can't really say it was the system, probably the story that we got into and what we were doing. On that list of easy games, this is not an easy intro.
No, this is definitely a level up game.
Stuff to learn, to the point where I'm like, in combat, because it's a lot of math, I actually rolled ahead of time before my turn just so I could give JM numbers to look up on the charts. It was quite
complicated. Sit there with a calculator on the couch. Like, we would be playing at the table, and you would walk away and sit down, and then you would come back.
Yes. 136, a 126, and a 96, and you'd like, okay, you hit, or yeah, it was very. Yeah, it's a good game. I'm not saying you shouldn't look at it, but it's not the simplest of games. Yeah, I know. I really got into that character, where I don't know, maybe in the past I wouldn't have made some of the choices. I mean, at one point I was ready to sacrifice myself for some things, and it didn't work. I didn't have to, but I think I took some risks. Don't even mention dancers in Polite Company anymore. Is evil. Yeah. If you've run into dancers in other games, you understand.
That whole campaign, it was all about the dancers.
I will, like, sometime, maybe later today, if people want to know, I will explain the dancers, but that is one of those things that have crossed many campaigns, like the Absolutist War that Nick was talking about, this game that Mark is talking about. The dancers are the most hated thing that has ever come out of my mind. And people, like, it somehow ratchets up the tension in a game.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Iconic. Tune in 2 weeks to hear the next part of this live recording where we talked about our favorite campaigns, what we learned about them, and answered questions from our Patreon and from the live chat that was going on at the time. Until next time, we'll see you in 2 weeks, and good gaming.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com. or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.